Okay. So it would seem at this point that we have the answers to some important questions. We can define what mindful awareness is in terms of three attentional skills that grow with time. Concentration power, which we define as the ability to focus on what you want, when you want, for as long as you want. Sensory clarity, which on one hand is the ability to separate out with awareness the fundamental strands or elements of sensory experience. So that's sort of the vipassana in the sense of seeing separate, or bina. There's also the clarity as in terms of that the awareness soaks into the sensory strand as it arises, which is traditionally by the Burmese masters called, quote, penetration. So you separate, and that's sort of the da'at. It's really knowing that sensory experience fully as it arises. You know down into it. That's the sensory clarity piece. As you shine in greater awareness on the surface of each sensory event, some of the light trickles down into the subconscious. We don't see directly there, but it gets what it needs to untie its own knots. And we notice that even though on the surface of our experience we're just sort of sleepy and confused and uncomfortable and frustrated because we can't concentrate and so forth, but then we leave the retreat and we notice our perceptions and behaviors have changed, and it's as though surgery has been done down in the depths of our being. We don't quite know how. That's because some of the awareness, the clarity, is trickling down into the subconscious. In the a Western formulation of what's below the surface of ordinary awareness, you have on one hand the Freudian, Sigmund Freud's view, well, the unconscious is the storehouse of all of our unresolved poison and pain. On the other hand, you have Carl Jung's view that the subconscious is the realm of the archetypes. It's the realm of special powers and unusual experiences, where angels and demons and ancestors and former lives and psychic significant archetypal experiences can occur. Actually, both views of the unconscious are true. From the Buddhist perspective, there's two words for the unconscious. On one hand, it's called the alaya vijnana, which means the storehouse of the samskaras, of the limiting forces, so that's a little bit like the Freudian point of view. On the other hand, it's called the sambhogakaya, or the body of archetypal glory, which is a little more the Jungian point of view. In any event, when we do the vipassana practice, we heighten the awareness on the surface, but some of it trickles down into the crevices and gives the unconscious what it needs to untie its own knots. So that's the sensory clarity piece, the different dimensions. Then there's the equanimity, which can be thought of in many different ways. It can be thought of as a kind of sensory passivity, in a positive sense of passive, meaning you're not pushing and pulling, you're not interfering with the natural flow of the sensory strands. So the concentration allows you to hold one sensory strand if you wish. The clarity allows you to be very precise about what's going on. The equanimity allows you to allows that sensory experience to expand and contract, to do whatever it wants to do without resistance, interference, or inappropriate holding. And it turns out that when we bring these three skills together and apply it to either ordinary sensory experience or interesting, pleasant, restful states, that this fosters many, many desirable effects. So that's sort of, okay, a model or a conceptual framework for what mindful awareness is. And I think that's becoming clearer and clearer that every procedure that you have been given in one way or another fosters that skill set. So then we also have a conceptual model, a fairly broad and I would say deep model for why we practice this, okay? Michal did a fantastic job of writing a big version of this in both English, Anglit, and Ivrit in Hebrew. And this is sort of covers just about every reason why we would do this practice. And although I do not have time right now to go into the specifics, each one of these items is facilitated by mindfulness skills. And if you want all the details, go to my YouTube channel, which is called Expand Contract. Just look up Shinzen Yang on YouTube, and you'll hear me go through a detailed sort of connecting of the dots of how mindfulness fosters each one of these things. I would say that the central issue is unconditional happiness for yourself. As you develop unconditional happiness for yourself, that improves the conditional happiness for yourself, and also naturally leads to service for the happiness of others. Why does it naturally lead to to service? Because one of the items in unconditional happiness for yourself is you get the answer, okay? That is to say, you get the answer to the question, what am I at the deepest level? The answer to that question, when you understand who you are at the deepest level, you also understand that your source. Okay, I like that word. The term is used by my teacher, Sasaki Roshi. He talks about kongen in Japanese. Kongen is the source of experience. It's the spiritual source, and you can say in Hebrew, Hamakor. So when you understand your source, which is the divine nothingness, you understand also that that's everyone's source. Everyone comes from that and returns to that moment by moment with each moment of consciousness. And that's, you understand this not as a concept, but as a direct experience, an undeniable, direct perception moment by moment. And so that when you come out of the source, it's not just you that comes out of the source, all your brothers and sisters, all other sentient beings in general, and specifically all other human beings, are born with you. So there is a natural sense of wanting to serve in one way or another. And it's a great paradox because the source is not personal. It's cold, and I wouldn't say cold, but it's not personal. And yet, when a human touches it, it improves our person. It fulfills us. as a person, and it also purifies our behavior as a person. Even though it is not good or bad, we become better by having touched it. And even though it is not pleasure or pain, we become happier by having touched it. So there flows from that a natural sense of wanting to serve, which takes many different forms. So this then gives us a sort of conceptual framework for why we do this. So now we have a sense of what we're doing, why we're doing it. Then there's the question, what do we need in order to be successful with this practice? In other words, what are the by what conditions or factors will we be able to be successful? I would suggest to you that one thing that you need to be successful with this practice is to do a little bit of formal meditation most days. Now, if you could do it in the morning, that's great because it sets up your whole day to continue the meditation. What is a minimum? Well, in my way of formulating it, I would say a minimum of 10 minutes. That might not seem like a lot, but to do, you could do much more. You could do a half hour, an hour, but to just about every day do at least 10 minutes of formal meditation. I don't mean relaxing in the bathtub meditation. I don't mean Tai Chi or yoga meditation. Okay, I don't mean I mean sit on the cushion and implement a formal technique, perhaps with spoken labels. If you really only have 10 minutes, start by speaking the labels out loud, because you need to get to work right away. Feel. You notice I didn't hesitate, okay? I can do it, I can start on a dime, okay? that's training, okay? Feel. You want something else? Sight. Touch. Okay, I can do any of them, okay? Want something more complicated? Sight. Feel, image, feel, sound, feel. Okay, just start on a dime, make your best guess, and you're off and running. You do that for 10 minutes, spoken labels minimum, most days. It's not a small thing. You might think it's, 10 minutes? But you might be surprised how much resistance you have to doing that. Okay, 10 minutes minimum for the rest of your life. Okay, this is a long-term endeavor. I'll use the bigger one. I'm bad at drawing. Okay. Something that grows this way, slowly, you said the right word. That's linear growth. That's called linear growth. Something that grows this way, exponential growth or snowball. At the beginning, when you look at the beginning, it's hard to tell the difference between a linear growth situation and an exponential growth situation. Of course, at the beginning is a relative term. What's the beginning of your practice? Okay, let's be honest. The beginning of your practice is about the first 10 years. Okay, that's the beginning of your... Well, if you consider that you're going to do it for your whole life, okay. The first 10 years is sort of the beginning. So in the first 10 years, it may seem like you're sort of growing linearly. It's like, yeah, I'm changing, I'm improving. It's better to do this than not be doing this. But at this rate, it's going to take me a million years to get to enlightenment. If the growth truly was linear, and you look at how much you grow in the first year, yes, you grew 10 miles, okay? And the journey is a million miles. But fortunately, the growth is is non-linear. It becomes evident somewhere down the line that the more you grow, the faster you grow. And the exponential runaway, the snowball effect, could become evident in 2 or 3 years, could become evident in 5 or 6 years, but it will very likely become evident within 10 years. That it's like, I'm not just growing in a linear way. This thing is going into a hockey stick situation. It's shaped like a hockey stick, okay? Maybe that's not a sport that is so popular, but where Soryu and I live, that's the name of the game, okay? Okay, so we're in it for the long haul. Now you say, well, wait, I'm already 55 years old, so I have no chance at all. Because the first 10 years is the beginning, I'll be dead before I finish the beginning. Well, the good news is, being older can be an advantage because you have more life experience. So you may be able to compensate for that, because really what this path is a catalyst. A catalyst is something that speeds up a reaction that will occur naturally anyway. That's what a catalyst is. So what is the reaction that will occur naturally anyway? Enlightenment. What is the cause of enlightenment? Life experience. What catalyzes life experience so that enlightenment comes before it's time to die is this practice. So don't worry if you're older, and I'm saying, well, you should keep this up, you know, years and decades and whatever. You may have a certain advantage just by being older. I'm not going to take questions during the Dharma talks, but we'll take them in the other parts of the retreat. Oh, by the way, you leave me questions, I will answer them if I can, but if I can't, it doesn't mean that I don't care about your question, okay? There's just way more questions than I can possibly address. It's just the nature of the thing. The practice will give you the answers with time. Okay, so what do you need to be successful? One thing is do a little bit of formal practice every day. That's formal practice, a technique. If it's noting and you don't have a lot of time, you might need to do it with spoken labels to guarantee quality if you don't have quantity. Now, Mr. Goenka, after you finish your first 10-day retreat, he does what in business is called the assumptive close. Okay, that's a term in sales. He says, now you will return home, and every day, each morning, you will sit for 1 hour And every evening you will sit for another hour. Okay, that's called the assumptive close. You just tell the person they're going to do it, and they assume they're going to do it. Okay, it's a sales technique. Well, if you can sit for an hour every morning and an hour every evening, that's great. The problem is people usually don't have that amount of time. And then when they can't do that, then they become discouraged. So I don't say, you know, devote 2 hours of every day to this practice, but do devote at a minimum 10 minutes quality practice. So you need to do that. You also need every once in a while to do intensive practice. That's called a retreat. This is a retreat, okay? Now, most, how much retreat? Well, I would say minimum is something like one week retreat per year. That's minimum, okay? The equivalent to that. And that's every year of your life and as long as you live. Now, if you can do that in a residential situation like this, where we're in silence and we're coming and we're just doing it, that's great. If you can't do that, there are other possibilities depending on where you live and how you want to work and so forth. You can do many weekend retreats. If you can't get the time off to do like a whole week or 10 days or something. Or you can do like 12 one-day retreats per year or something like that if you live in a place where that's feasible. It's also possible to even break it up into smaller doses, and I'll be discussing that later in the retreat when I describe to you my what I call the home practice program, which is a telephone-based retreat that you do in your home or from some place that's convenient for you, so you don't have to leave your home. We bring the retreat to you. Now, I know that you can't conceptualize how this works. I know as soon as I say, hey, we're going to implement a retreat in your home by telephone or in your office or whatever it is, I know that the person's thinking, telephone, my home, I don't get it. What's this going to be? Okay, I know what people think. And then you do it. Or you, that, now this is the assumptive close, okay? When you leave this retreat, you will try one of my home practice retreats. And then you will understand how well it works. Okay, so, well, maybe you'll try it. But it is a convenient way to do it because it's in 4-hour blocks. And I have found that 4 hours, if it's tightly structured and done the right way, can give you all the features that you would get at a retreat. And I have people all around the world that do one or two of those per month. And they live. Some of them live in places where they could never travel to a retreat. Some of them are sick. They can't leave their homes. People don't have money. They can't afford. Well, we bring the practice to them. And that's it can be divided that finely. As I say, I'll describe that in some detail maybe towards the end of the retreat. So one way or another, either in a residential situation or day retreats or self-retreat, you go off by yourself, or a more modern phone-based practice, home practice program delivery system, you need to get in some intensive momentum of practice time, I would say minimum 1 week per year for your whole life. Then the other thing that you need is contact with at least one competent professional coach who can give you some type of a regular contact. someone who can you can touch base with on your practice, what's happening, that can give you input, give you suggestions, and so forth. Personally, I do not like the traditional master, disciple, or teacher-student formulation. That works for some people, but I think of myself as a highly competent coach, like in sports, okay? It's like I can sit down with you and I can show you how to do this thing. And as the months and years go on, you're gonna be a psycho-spiritual athlete as the result of this training. By the way, that's what the Christian monks and nuns in the Middle Ages called their endeavor. Ascesis in Greek means athletic training. In fact, even the word exercise was originally meant spiritual exercises that were meditations done in the Greek Orthodox or in the Eastern Orthodox and Roman Catholic traditions. So they did think of themselves as spiritual athletes. So it's difficult to make progress without some input from a professional coach. But you don't have to find the great master, the perfect master. You don't have to surrender to the lotus feet of the guru. Just find at least one person that knows what they're talking about, that you can relate to guide your practice. As far as I'm concerned, I don't put any, there's no strings attached. You want to make use of my services, you do my programs. You want to study with other people, you want to do other techniques, that's fine. In fact, that's good. As long as who you're studying with are competent to lead you to classical enlightenment, then good. I'm happy to outsource the task and let other teachers be involved in your training. So now, how do you get contact? Well, for one thing, you're going to get my personal telephone number and my email. I give that to anyone that has done a retreat with me. But when you do the home practice program, there's a period of time during each of those programs where I am available, like office hours. You can call me and talk one-on-one. So you actually can get private interviews every month by participating in the home practice program. They're not long, okay? Typically, I have about 50 people on a call, and we give an hour when you're working on your own where you can call me at my home and we talk. So I got about 50 people, and typically about 1 out of 10 needs to talk to me, and I can give each one 10 minutes and in that hour, and I can sort of cover it. And if that's not enough, then we make an appointment to talk by phone at some future time as soon as possible. So that's one way of structuring so that you can have some regular contact with a coach, with a teacher. So the combination of doing a little bit each day, a lot every once in a while, plus regular sort of discussion with somebody who's competent to guide you, keep that up for the duration of your life. You're not monks, you're not nuns, you are householders. So that means that you have to parcel out your enlightenment a little more slowly, okay? If you're living in a monastery and there's nothing to do 24/7 but transcend your mind and body, then you can probably do that in a few years. But if you want to have a career and relationships and hobbies and the internet and, you know, do all these other things that householders do, fine. Then it's going to probably take a little longer. So you just have to think of, like, the long term. Is it feasible if you do the three things I just said, a little bit of practice each day, a lot of practice every once in a while, contact with a teacher. Actually, there's one more thing I didn't mention. You have to attempt to bring the mindfulness into your daily life. Now, that's challenging. The way I think about it is that as you go, let you finish your morning meditation, assuming you do it in the morning. If you can't do it in the morning, okay, but you finish your morning. Well, let's just put it this way. You finish your formal meditation period. At the end of that, you think about the day to come. What's going to happen? What are going to be the situations you're going to be in? Who you're going to meet? The events? And you think ahead, okay, how will I attempt to systematically be mindful in at least some of these situations? It's perhaps not reasonable at an early time in your practice that you would be mindful continuously through the day. But you can be mindful for short moments during certain circumstances. So you think ahead in the day and you think, okay, this is going to happen, but that's too complicated. I can't do a practice during that. But then there's this other thing that's fairly simple. So during that, I'm going to focus on feel, or I'm going to radiate loving kindness, or I'm going to do whatever. You formulate strategies that you'll use for brief moments as you go about activities that are simple enough to do so. So maybe you say, okay, well, I work in an office, I got to be thinking, and I'm on the computer, and so I can't meditate while I'm doing that, but every time I go to the bathroom, I'm going to be aware of walking, I'm going to be aware of touching the doorknob, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So I call that practice in life. So for a few seconds here or a few minutes there, as you go about life activities, you attempt to be mindful. And then the rest of the time, you just do whatever you have to do. So there's that intention to practice in life. If you can, it's really good to be able to, during the day, stop everything for maybe a minute or 5 minutes. You just stop, and you give yourself a brief period of formal practice. Feel, feel, image, touch, touch, sight, okay? And you do that for 30 seconds or 5 minutes, then you go back. So I call that those surgical strikes. You know, in military, a surgical strike, it's a very precise attack. It's not scattered, okay? So you sort of do a little thing like that if you can. So the combination of a little bit of formal practice each day, plus periodic intensive retreats, contact with teacher, at least one, on a regular basis, plus the intention to bring at least a little bit of mindful, formal, and settle into some life activity every day, even if it's just when you're washing the dishes, it's touch, sight, sound of washing the dishes and so forth. That kept up over your whole life. Is it feasible that you could experience at least the first levels of classical enlightenment? And I would say emphatically, the answer is yes. That's conceivable. That's reasonable. Will you become what's called an arhat, a fully enlightened being? Maybe not. Okay. That's quite an endeavor. Okay. The distance between endeavor is a job. Yeah, a job. Okay. An undertaking, a project. To become a fully enlightened being, well, there's not that many around on the planet. Okay, that'll tell you how rare that is. You know. But stream enterers, people that have had what in the Zen tradition is called Kensho, or initial Satori, or what in Theravada Buddhism is called stream entry, you've all been around stream enterers, okay? I don't say they're a dime a dozen, but I guarantee you that that's not so unusual. So that's feasible. I'm not guaranteeing that it's going to happen. But just to give you a ballpark, okay, full enlightenment, that's fairly rare. The initial experience of freedom, that is not a peak experience that you're going to lose, but it's a permanent shift in understanding about the nature of self, where you go from having a limited identity to having an elastic identity for the rest of your life, that's reasonable. Not guaranteed, but with the amount of time and effort under competent guidance, it's a feasible endeavor for you. So that will give you some idea of what you need in order to be successful with this practice. So now you know what the practice is, its essence. You know the various reasons we do the practice. And so that's sort of the what and the why. And now you have an idea of the how in terms of what factors are needed for success. So now let's talk about the where. Where do we do mindfulness? Well, we do mindfulness in our sensory experience. So I've given you a classification of one possible classification of sensory experience. Broadly, our sensory experience is in three modalities: visual, auditory, and somatic. Somatic is the Greek word meaning relating to body. Body sensation. So I like to distinguish the more subjective side of those, which I call feel, image, talk, and the more objective side that I call touch, sight, sound. So that gives you what might be described as six sensory spaces. Now it so happens that touch space and feel space are the same space. Sight space is out in front of you, image space is wherever the images are, and sound space is however you conceive of sound. Talk space is in your head. Very roughly speaking, it's something, it could be pictured. No, that's not what I wanted to do. I'm not good at drawings. That's a little better. So, this is the somatic, the body, okay? This is the visual, this is the auditory. This is a schematic diagram. So have image here and sight here. Okay, this is the subjective, objective. Then you have external sound and internal talk, and you have touch, and here's feel. So you can, I don't know if you can see all the way in the back, but it's sort of like a three-leaf clover. the surface of these things is the ordinary experience, but then there can also be sort of restful states. There's a restful aspect we can contact. But then as we go deeper, we start to experience a sense of that these things are sort of like waves. They're vibratory. And as we go all the way to the bottom, we come to something like a point that's outside of time and space, the still point of the turning world. And it's from that zero that this whole sensory field rises and passes away moment by moment. Another way to conceive of it is, if this is the surface of consciousness, and this is the source of consciousness, we are making a journey from surface to the source. Along this journey, and this journey can be made in the auditory world, it can be made in the somatic world, it can be made in the visual world. As we make this journey, we encounter ordinary experiences, then we may encounter restful states. Then we start to see that all of those are really wavy, vibratory sort of energy. And then at some point, we start to notice the vanishings of things. We're drawn to the endings. I'm speaking now. At the end of each one of these sentences, there's a period. That's the end of that burst of talk. That's where that sound goes to, which is also exactly where the next sound comes from. And likewise, for all sensory experience. Each time we are... So, a lot of times when people... observe things, they come to me and they say, I'm not doing it right. And I say, okay, well, what's the problem? They say, well, as soon as I'm aware of it, it disappears. That's not a sign you're not doing it right. That's a sign that you are aware of the impermanent nature of experience. So I like to start people out by clarifying ordinary sensory experience, and then they can also see that they can focus on pleasant, restful experiences, but those experiences are still somatic, visual, auditory, and so forth. At some point, as you're paying attention to touch, sight, sound, feel, image, talk, relaxation, light, silence, peace, blank, quiet, you may be drawn to the fact that they're not completely static, that they sort of, there's waviness or vibration. This may happen. You don't need to make it happen, but it's just something to know about. If that theme becomes prominent, you can really focus on how it's changing. And the more you focus on how it changes, the more evident the change becomes. And the flow, so things tend to turn into energy. Now, energy is an interesting word. Energy has a meaning in physics. And if you go on the Wikipedia, and you look up in the English language Wikipedia, and you look up the word energy, there's long article about all the different forms of energy known in physics. There's very nice mathematical formulations of what energy is. It's the line integral of force. It's the time derivative of power. Okay, there's a very rigorous scientific thing. And then there's this little thing that says, and people that are into spiritual paths misuse the word energy. They're too stupid to understand all of this. And they are careless, and they call all sorts of experiences that they have energy, but that's just proves how stupid they are. I mean, it doesn't exactly say that, but it sort of implies that. It's like, you're not smart enough to understand calculus or physics, so you call these experiences that you have energy, you know, and get over it, whatever. Well, actually, historically speaking, the word energia in Greek came...
Energia.
Yes, energia, right? What came to have its modern meaning in physics only in the 1830s. It's a fairly recent use of that word. Prior to that time, it was a technical term in the vocabulary of Christian meditative practice. And what it referred to was the experience of your mind and your body and your feelings turning into this sort of expanding, contracting, vibrating field where within which this working of the spirit is breaking up your impurities, purifying your consciousness, taking out the lumps in the substance of your soul, and pulling you back into the beatific vision, the direct experience of God. It is the Haruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, working within the human as force and movement that is dissolving the somethingness, taking you into a kind of experience of the flow of spirit, which then takes you into the absolute rest of the Shalom Bimromav, okay, the peace of heaven. So in Greek, en means within or inside, and ergon means work. It was actually originally wergon in Greek, but they lost the W. So in German, werk, in English, work, that's cognate to the ergon or wergon of Greek. So the working of the flow within you to purify your consciousness, what it Ubat Khin, the Burmese master, called activating impermanence, okay? I call that the theme of flow. The flow can occur in the ordinary states, it can occur in the restful states. If it becomes prominent, you can focus on it. The flow experiences break down the distinctions that we make with the other techniques. So Vipassana starts by making discriminations, but at some level you get so deep, the clarity becomes so fine, that you come to an experience that unifies everything. So the flow sort of unifies things into an energy field, and then you start to notice that there's all these vanishings, and each vanishing points to the still point that is Hamakor. So we're not going to have a chance to go into it in the great detail that I would like to, but I'll just point out to you that if at some point in your practice, inside the ordinary experiences of touch, sights, touch, feel, image, talk, or inside the relaxation, the peace, the blank, the quiet, you start to get a lot of sense of movement, you can focus on that, and it will break down the distinctions between body and mind, inside and outside. You let that happen. You let things just dissolve. You could say that your concentration, clarity, and equanimity is equivalent to a cocoon. You know what I mean by cocoon? That's maybe a rare word. Okay. Everybody know what I meant then? Okay. So your meditation technique is this cocoon. The caterpillar, the bug, right? Caterpillar puts itself inside a cocoon, and then it lets its structure dissolve. But it is in the nature of the caterpillar that if it completely lets go, you might say it has a kind of emun, as opposed to emuna, okay? It has this faith. If I completely let go inside this cocoon, what will happen is my butterfly nature will manifest. So the caterpillar dissolves. If you've ever dissected, when I was a little boy, I was not a Buddhist, okay? So I dissected cocoons. And and it's like when I open it up, it's like, it's just liquid in there. Okay, that's all that's there. The caterpillar has dissolved. There's no caterpillar. What's going to happen, though, is it's in the nature of nature. Inside that safe environment, that caterpillar dissolves into flow. It's just liquid. But then that flow reorganizes into butterfly. Well, a completely different creature. So that's a metaphor. That's a metaphor for how this path works. If at some point you start to turn to liquid, you don't need to worry. Just give yourself to that. Mind and body integrate, inside and outside integrate. It's just waves and vibration, expansion, contraction. You have emun, okay? You have this trust or faith, which is different from belief. Belief is holding on. Faith is letting go. You let go into the energy. It tears you apart, and then it puts you back together in as a new self. Atzmi Hadash? Would that be correct? Okay, so that's the theme of impermanence. Impermanence is not something different from sensory experience. It's what happens to sensory experience when we bring enough concentration, clarity, and equanimity to it. In other words, it's the nature of sensory experience. And the reason we know that that is the case is we're not trying to make any of this happen. We're just paying very close attention, either to touch or feel or image or talk or relaxation, peace, the blank, the quiet. But if this theme presents itself, you can go with this theme. Let it work on you. It's energia. It's ruach. Working within your sensory experience to reduce you. In the Latin sense of the word, to reduce means reducere. Re means back. Ducere means lead. Okay? You're literally being reduced or led back to the source by the flow. And you notice the vanishings, vanishing, vanishing, vanishing. Each vanishing points you to the still point. And that is the process that in the Kabbalah is called the annihilation of the somethingness of self and world, the Bitul Hayesh. And then there is, from that, the reappearance. The same, but different. So that's the big picture of how this works. When you go back to the source, you realize it's everyone's source. So the self that's reborn is a more caring human self. So now we have a pretty good idea of what this practice is, why do it, the factors that we need. We know where we do it in our sensory experiences. And we also know where we do it in the sense that it takes us to the place, hamakom, in the sense of our spiritual source. So I would say that that's a pretty good conceptual framework. We've answered a lot of questions about this. Also, I want to congratulate all of you for a very sincere practice in the interviews. It is definitely coming out that you are understanding this by and large, and you are able to do this. So it's good work, and we've got several more days to ride on this momentum. That's right now?
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, just to remind you, we're going to do the metta or focus on positive. I guess we'll take a little break,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Come back. And then who's leading it? Soryu is going to be leading you in that process. I'm going to be giving interviews.